content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the November 26th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a clear blue sky. From underneath, you see a group of arms and hands reaching up, all different colors, like they're grasping. Up in the air, kind of floating like balloons, are a number of products. A Thanksgiving turkey, a loaf of bread, a gas tank, television, a car. They all have dollar sign tags attached to what would be like the balloon string. And the headline is, Up, Up, and Away. Do soaring prices signal a return to the economic misery of the 1970s? We'll get that story on the controversy of the week. We'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Bannon charged with contempt over January 6 defiance. What happened? A defiant Steve Bannon surrendered to federal authorities and appeared in court this week after the former President Trump advisor was indicted on contempt of Congress charges for refusing to cooperate with the House Special Committee investigating the January 6 insurrection. Bannon vowed in combative terms to fight the charges, escalating a battle between the committee and the former president, who has refused to cooperate and directed his former associates to do likewise. They took on the wrong guy this time, said Bannon, who cast the prosecution as a politically motivated gambit by an illegitimate administration. We're taking down the Biden regime. After the 2020 election, Bannon took part in a war room set up by Trump associates to find a way to overturn the election results. And on January 5th, he said on a podcast, all hell is going to break loose tomorrow. The House committee is trying to determine whether the Trump administration and Republican office holders were involved in planning and abetting the violent Capitol invasion. The Justice Department's decision to pursue charges against Bannon marked a victory for the Democrat-dominated panel, which so far has privately interviewed some 200 witnesses. The panel has subpoenaed 35 people, including many former senior Trump aides, among them Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, who last week failed to appear for a deposition, Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany, and Trump body man turned top advisor Johnny McEntee. Bannon's indictment should send a clear message to anyone who thinks they can ignore the Select Committee or stonewall our investigation, said Chair Benny Thompson, Democrat from Mississippi, and Vice Chair Liz Cheney, the Republican from Wyoming. Republicans rallied around Bannon, accusing Democrats of weaponizing the Justice Department and vowing to compel testimony from Biden aides if they regain the House next year. In a newly released interview with Jonathan Carl of ABC News, Trump defended supporters who chanted "Hang Mike Pence" during the insurrection, saying it was common sense given Pence's refusal to deny certification of the Electoral College vote. The people were very angry, Trump said. How can you pass on a fraudulent vote to Congress? What the editorial said. The Select Committee no doubt has partisan motives, said the Wall Street Journal, but Bannon has no legal standing to dodge a lawful subpoena. Trump's claim of executive privilege is especially specious, given that Bannon left the White House 3 years earlier and was a private citizen in 2020. Congress' institutional power to conduct investigations needs to be vindicated, and Republicans who are complaining now will feel differently when they're back in power. Many disturbing details have emerged since that terrible day, said the Washington Post. including the extent of efforts to strong-arm Pence and a cascade of warnings of potential violence that were ignored by the FBI and law enforcement. But many key questions remain. How did rioters appear to know which Capitol windows had not been modernized and would be easy to breach? What did Trump do during the horrific 187 minutes that passed between when he beseeched his followers to march on the Capitol and when he begrudgingly called them off? Finding answers is critical in assuring that nothing like January 6 will happen again. What the columnist said. Bannon's indictment is a game changer for the investigation, said Chris Salisa in CNN.com. The first person charged with contempt of Congress since 1983, Bannon was hit with two counts that could each fetch a year in prison. Attorney General Merrick Garland has sent a strong message to other holdouts that the stakes for noncompliance are now very serious. Garland's pursuit of this weak case may have been met with glee in the media Democrat complex, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com, but it won't ever land Bannon in the witness chair. Even if it did, he could simply take the fifth. Bannon's pointless prosecution will only serve to confirm that the Biden-Garland Justice Department is a crude weapon of the political left. Bannon doesn't have a leg to stand on legally, but he knows exactly what he's doing, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. He and other January 6 plotters are like right-wing versions of the Chicago 7, and their radical strategy is purely political, to discredit and undermine the legal and constitutional system that once bound U.S. society, a system Trumpists have already badly eroded. American democracy is entering a strange and perilous period, said David Rohde in TheNewYorker.com. As Bannon's case plays out, Americans will have to decide whether its theatrics are a threat to democracy, performative branding, or a mix of both. Such cases can take up to a year, said former Justice Department official David Loftman, though there's substantial federal interest in moving quickly. As Loftman said, what can be of greater interest than an attack on the heart of democracy in the United States? We'll read the second main story. Climate summit ends with no firm pledges. What happened? The United Nations climate summit in Glasgow ended last week with an agreement among nearly 200 nations to reduce planet warming emissions and to move away from fossil fuels, a deal that scientists and activists warned lacked the urgency and enforcement mechanisms needed to avert the most disastrous effects of global warming. Some breakthroughs were made at the two-week conference. More than 100 countries agreed to limit emissions of methane, a potent greenhouse gas, and the U.S. and China, the world's two largest emitters of carbon dioxide, pledged to cooperate more on battling climate change. But negotiators failed to agree on emissions reduction goals to hit the target of the 2015 Paris Accord, limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial temperatures. The world is on pace to warm 2.5 degrees Celsius this century. Instead, the final Glasgow Agreement requests that countries revisit their emissions cuts next year. Language in the final deal calling for countries to phase out coal power, the single biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions, was replaced with a weaker pledge to phase down its use following last-minute demands from China and India. Still, the agreement marked the first time that fossil fuels or coal have been mentioned and implicitly blamed for climate change in a UN deal. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the Glasgow Agreement a compromise and said he understood that many people would be disappointed by the text. The path of progress is not always a straight line, he said. Sometimes there are ditches. What the editorial said. What a colossal failure, said the Los Angeles Times. We need bold and swift action to tackle our climate emergency, but this summit produced timid compromises, far-off pledges, and watered-down commitments. Sure, President Biden cleared the low bar set by former President Donald Trump, who abandoned the 2015 Paris climate deal, But Biden is still dragging his feet on many climate issues, including providing aid to help poorer nations deal with the drought, flooding, and other already occurring climate impacts. No one should be surprised that this summit was a carbon-neutral, plant-based nothing burger, said NationalReview.com. The grandees who gather for these conferences would rather spout meaningless eco-blather than take the practical but unpopular actions that would actually make a difference. That includes converting relatively dirty coal-fired power plants to relatively clean natural gas generation and building more nuclear power plants, which produce zero carbon electricity. But that would mean angering the environmentalists who seem to dictate the world's climate change policies. What the columnist said, America played a vital role in the progress that was made at the summit, said Stephen Mufson and Michael Birnbaum in the Washington Post. U.S. climate envoy John Kerry managed to corral other countries into agreements to cut methane and fight deforestation. And the American delegation also helped convince Japan, South Korea, China, and other nations to stop financing coal plants abroad. After Trump yanked the country from the global stage, it's clear the U.S. is back at the forefront of galvanizing international action. Glasgow was a tale of two globes, said Tina Gearhart in TheNation.com. The world's 20 leading economies are responsible for 80% of global emissions, which disproportionately harm poorer countries that lack the resources needed to cope with extreme weather and rising seas. But those rich countries still refuse to commit to hard cuts in emissions, and they have yet to honor a 2009 agreement under which they were supposed to pay $100 billion a year to help developing countries adapt to climate change. Our politics do not match the urgency of what the atmosphere is telling us, said John Sutter in CNN.com. Glasgow proved that delegates will always put their own short-term national interest ahead of the future of humanity. But the system of international haggling, flawed as it is, remains our best hope for survival. The process is moving far, far too slowly, but it is moving. Controversy of the week is inflation, a return to the economy of the 1970s. Get ready for the most expensive Thanksgiving dinner in history, said Alfredo Ortiz in RealClearPolitics.com. Last week, the U.S. Labor Department confirmed that runaway price inflation is back and threatening to cast the same dark shadow over the 2020s as it did the 1970s. Consumer prices have risen by 6.2% since this time last year, the largest year-on-year jump since 1990, with particularly pain-inducing spikes in such vital commodities as meat, up 14.5%, gasoline up 50%, and heating oil, which is up a staggering 59% as we head into winter. President Biden did his best to sound empathetic this week, calling rising prices worrisome. But he helped fuel the problem back in March, pumping $1.9 trillion of COVID stimulus into an economy that was already rebounding. And there isn't much he can do now to put out the fire. Nothing destroys presidencies like inflation, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. Next year's midterms were already looking like a bloodbath for Biden's party, with his job approval rating sinking to a new low of 41%. Large-scale forces beyond Biden's powers to fix are driving prices up globally, but he and his aides didn't help matters by spending months insisting that inflation was transitory. Last week's figures, sounding ominous echoes of the 1970s, should be a fire bell in the night for Democrats. Don't panic, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. The present moment looks less like the 1970s than like 1947, when the end of World War II triggered a massive surge in consumer demand, much like the one that's snarling supply chains and driving up prices today. At that time, inflation peaked at 22%. Then in 1948, prices dropped dramatically, as they likely will next year when consumers run out of stimulus cash and COVID-shuttered factories and warehouses fully reopen. That optimistic view looked more plausible in the spring, said former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers in the Washington Post, but it's time for Team Transitory to stand down. Prices are rising across all sectors of commodity goods, and when Biden appoints a Fed chairman and several other members of the central bank in early 2022, containing inflation should be priority number one. Labor shortages present another problem, said Yvonne Abraham in BostonGlobe.com. Americans quit their jobs in record numbers during the pandemic. This forced businesses to raise wages to woo replacements, leading to higher prices for the goods those businesses produce. If workers demand even higher wages to keep pace with those prices, we'll be in the dreaded wage price spiral that really did define the 1970s. Remember the big picture, said John Cassidy in NewYorker.com. Inflation is occurring globally for the best of reasons. Governments avoided the all-out collapse of their economies by directly putting money into people's pockets. Then vaccines arrived quickly, causing consumer demand to rebound with unexpected speed. Uncertainties remain, but as the pandemic recedes and people again spend money on travel, entertainment, and other services instead of just goods, the inflation outlook is far from hopeless. Biden's fate depends on it, said Jonah Goldberg in the Los Angeles Times. If prices are still rising when the midterm congressional elections arrive next year, voters will be in a bad mood, and Democrats will probably be swept from office. If inflation lasts into 2024, Biden is doomed to join Jimmy Carter in the one-termers club. Here's our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for public health with an Austrian brothel's offer of free sex with a lady of your choice to any customer who takes advantage of its on-site COVID-19 vaccination center. We have a great vaccination site, said the brothel's owner. It was a good week for snowflakes, with the unveiling during Dubai's Design Week Festival of the Themis, a lamp-sized device that monitors human speech and sets off an extremely annoying alarm lasting 2 minutes if it hears any racist remarks or offensive jokes. It was a good week for theocrats after retired General Michael Flynn, former President Trump's national security advisor, told a crowd on the far-right Reawaken America tour that if we are going to have one nation under God, which we must, we have to have one religion. He did not specify which one. But it was a bad week for legal briefs after a lawyer trying to enter a Philadelphia courtroom grew frustrated when the metal detector kept rejecting his suspenders, so he stripped down to his underwear. I used poor judgment, Jeffrey Pollack said after being cited for disorderly conduct. It was a bad week for air rage after United Airlines announced it will resume sales of hard liquor in economy class despite the ongoing problem of customers becoming violent when told they must wear masks. Finally, it was a bad week for law and order after Michigan's Attorney General Dana Nessel apologized for drinking so much at a recent Michigan-Michigan State football game that she had to be escorted out of the stadium in a wheelchair. The assisted exit was necessary, Nessel explained, so as to prevent me from vomiting on any of my constituents. In other news, a short piece here. Infrastructure bill signed into law. President Biden signed the long-awaited $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill in a White House ceremony, calling it proof that despite the cynics, Democrats and Republicans can come together. In a rare bipartisan showing, some of the 19 Republican senators and 13 GOP House members who backed the bill attended the signing event. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell voted for the legislation but skipped the signing. Former President Trump, who endorsed infrastructure spending during his term but never passed a bill, has said Republicans who voted for this bill should be ashamed of themselves for helping the Democrats. Biden tapped former Democratic New Orleans Mayor Mitch Landrieu to coordinate the plan's implementation and minimize waste. The briefing this week is titled, Who Pays America's Taxes? During the debate over spending bills, Democrats proposed raising taxes on the wealthy. Do the rich pay a fair share? What do the wealthy pay? Generally, a much lower percentage of their incomes than the middle class. A White House study released in September found that America's 400 wealthiest families paid an average federal income tax rate of just 8.2% from 2010 to 2018. The rich do pay other taxes not included in the White House analysis, such as estate taxes, but in recent decades, most kinds of taxes on the wealthy have been substantially cut. The marginal tax rate for the top tax bracket held at above 63% between 1932 and 1982, spiking as high as 92% in the 1950s. Now, after decades of cuts that started during the Reagan administration, the top marginal rate stands at 37%. In addition, payroll taxes to finance Social Security and Medicare are levied on laborers and CEOs at the same rate, and only up to $142,800 in income. If you include all taxes, such as sales and state taxes, the country's top 1% earn about 21% of total income and pay about 24% of total taxes, making our tax system progressive, but mildly so. Why isn't it more progressive? In writing and amending the tax code over the decades, Congress has been heavily influenced by the political contributions of wealthy Americans and large corporations, and the armies of lobbyists they send to Washington. Investment income is taxed at a much lower rate than salaries, on the theory that this encourages business growth that stimulates the economy. The tax code is also filled with loopholes and deductions only the wealthy can take. An analysis by ProPublica earlier this year, based on a trove of leaked IRS data, showed that mega billionaires Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Warren Buffett have paid no federal income taxes at all in some years, and a very low percentage on their massive gains in wealth. Bezos, one of the world's richest men, paid $973 million in personal federal taxes on $4.2 billion in reported income between 2014 and 2018. His wealth, mostly in the form of Amazon stock, increased by $99 billion during that same period, giving him a true tax rate of 0.98%, ProPublica said. Corporations pull similar tricks. Between 2018 and 2020, 39 S&P or Fortune 500 companies managed to pay no income tax while recording a combined $122 billion in profits. How do they do it? Corporations and the super affluent can employ accountants and lawyers who know how to manipulate their capital gains, interest, and dividends. Executives paid in stock, for instance, can sell their losing investments at the end of the year to zero out their taxable growth. The wealthy also engage in asset-based lending, borrowing money against their portfolio rather than selling appreciated investments that may incur capital gains taxes. Rich Americans can keep wealth in the family by passing assets to heirs and exploiting a loophole called step-up in basis. This means the value of an inherited asset generally adjusts to what it's worth on the date of its original owner's death, meaning years or decades of gains before that date instantly becomes tax-free. As long as you're adhering to the law, said Sharif Muhammad, founder and CEO of Unlimited Financial Services, everything's fair game. Can wealth itself be taxed? Oregon Senator Ron Wyden and some other Democrats recently pushed for a billionaire tax that would tax the richest Americans on unrealized capital gains. But such a tax would face constitutional challenges, and billionaires quickly accused progressives of waging class warfare. Eventually, they run out of other people's money, and then they come for you, tweeted Musk, the Tesla CEO, who's worth roughly $280 billion. From a practical standpoint, taxing unrealized gains would require a major revamping of the tax system, giving an already overwhelmed IRS the tricky task of valuing assets such as private businesses. Who does the tax code favor? It has a strong bias for investment income over wages and thus worsens income inequality. The top 10% now own 70% of the wealth, up from 60% in 1990. And any attempt to alter the status quo runs into powerful, well-financed opposition. The Biden administration plans to raise taxes for spending bills, for example, have met in a torrent of organized corporate opposition on Capitol Hill. We're doing it in every way you can imagine, said Eric Newsom, the senior vice president for policy at the National Association of Manufacturers. So far, those lobbying efforts have been successful. Though a 15% corporate minimum tax and a surtax on incomes over $10 million remain on the table. Proposals to increase tax rates on the wealthy and corporations have been dropped. How the IRS was gutted. The IRS has never been America's most popular government agency, and conservatives have harbored suspicions about its usefulness since the 1990s. Their hostility escalated dramatically in 2013, with reports that Tea Party groups seeking tax-exempt status were receiving extra scrutiny. The IRS also targeted groups with progressive and green and other partisan labels in their names, but enraged Republicans accused the agency of bias and political persecution. They escalated their efforts to cut the IRS budget, reducing the number of auditors by one-third. In 2017, the IRS conducted 675,000 fewer audits than it did in 2010, a drop of 42%. And auditors are stretched so thin that they are reluctant to take on complex returns filed by the wealthiest citizens. As a result, the IRS now audits Americans who receive the earned income tax credit, whose incomes are about $20,000, at about the same rate as people earning $500,000 to a million. For this to change, Pam Reeks, former IRS manager, told ProPublica, the IRS needs a bigger budget and more employees. You can see all this abuse and fraud and people not paying their taxes, she said, but you can't use your hands to get it. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with what Europe's COVID wave tells us. Profound pandemic fatigue has led to the irresistible notion that the pandemic end is nigh, said Eric Topol. A serious new surge of the Delta variant in Europe should warn us that we're in denial about what lies ahead this winter. Cases are surging in both sparsely vaccinated Eastern European nations and countries such as Ireland and Belgium, where vaccination rates exceed 70%. Denmark, which lifted all its pandemic restrictions in September after vaccinating more than 86% of everyone over 12, has reinstated vaccine passports as COVID surges. In many countries, it is unvaccinated children and teens who are primarily spreading the super infectious variant. The coming of cold weather and waning vaccine effectiveness after 6 months are also contributing. In the U.S., less than 60% of the population has been fully vaccinated, and with many parts of the country spurning masks and distancing as people move indoors, cases are already spiking in several states, especially in rural areas. The holidays will accelerate that trend, Unless we heed the European signal and ramp up vaccinations, boosters, and other mitigation efforts, history will repeat itself, and we will probably face a fifth wave. Christie's belated awakening. Chris Christie is trying to pull the Republican Party out of Donald Trump's grip, said Alex Shepard. But it's a doomed project. The brash, big-mouthed former New Jersey governor seemed to be a viable contender for the GOP presidential nomination in 2016. But Trump, with far more brazen and even reckless rhetoric, stole his brand. Christie reacted by endorsing Trump and displaying such meek deference, he came off like Trump's servant. While serving as Trump's debate preparer in 2020, Christie caught COVID and nearly died. Now he is exploring another presidential run and telling Republicans it's time to stop obsessing over that lost election and move on. But the time to stand up to Trump was in 2016, or at least in the aftermath of January 6. Today, any Republican who rejects Trump, including Representative Liz Cheney, is being condemned for treason and exiled. When Trump savaged the 13 House Republicans who voted for President Biden's infrastructure bill, the GOP stripped them of committee assignments. Meanwhile, the Republican base is consumed by insane conspiracy theories about the election and vaccines. So Christie's halfway rebuke of Trumpism will gain no traction. It's Trump's party now, from top to bottom. This column comes from the UK. New uses for our famous phone booths. Kids today just can't understand their parents' fondness for the once ubiquitous red telephone booth, said Tom Utley. Nearly all Britons now own a cell phone. 90% of children have one by age 11. So youngsters find it utterly bemusing that us olds used to wait in line at public call boxes, hunting around in our pockets for coins. Call volumes from payphones have plummeted from 800 million minutes in 2002 to only 7 million in 2020. But the British phone box remains a simply gorgeous example of urban design, and that's why campaigners across the country are battling so fiercely to save these relics of a past age from the scrap heap. Government regulators said last week that 5,000 of the 21,000 remaining red boxes would be maintained as public payphones, particularly in rural areas where cell phone reception is spotty and along highways with high rates of accidents. Telecoms firm BT is offering to sell many of the rest to community organizations for the token sum of £1 each, about $1.35. Some villages are now using the booths to house defibrillators for public use, others as little free libraries, still others as art galleries. Let's keep those ideas coming and save as many of these icons as we can. We've got an intriguing title to The Last Word, our feature article. It is My Father, the Hitman. I knew that my father was a tough guy who was often on the run or in prison, said author James Dolan in D Magazine. But it was only after he was murdered that I discovered just how dangerous he was. My dad had gotten out of prison, and for the first time in years, we were sitting down to dinner. It turned out to be the last time I ever saw him alive. This was 1984. We were at Newport's in Dallas West End, drinking Anchor Steam beers, and the mood was one of celebration. A former light heavyweight boxer, my dad was still physically imposing, even at 70 years old. But he was slimmer after his most recent stint inside. His sports coat hung loose on him, and his red blonde hair had thinned. His name was James Dolan, same as mine, but everyone called him Doc. He's been in and out of my life since I was a boy, But when I was in my early 30s, Doc and I reconnected. That night, we discussed his most recent bust for a three-card Monty scam he pulled in Memphis before twice jumping bail. From there, he got to talking about the Dallas Campisi family, Italian restaurateurs who had a reputation for being in the mafia. He talked about Jack Ruby, how some said he was a mafioso too, how Ruby had really wanted to be seen as a tough guy. Being around Doc felt like being in a closed space with a circus tiger. It was exciting because there was a real danger, more than I realized for most of my life. A few weeks before we met at Newport's, he'd taken me to a bank and had me open a safe deposit box we could share. He showed me roughly $30,000 in cash, the most money I'd ever seen in one place. He said I could take it from the box as needed, but he told me not to hit it too hard. That night at Newport's, he asked me about the house I'd recently bought in Oak Cliff. Unprompted, he said that if there ever came a time I couldn't make the mortgage payment, I could put it in the sky. I asked him what he meant. Like that little house in Miami, he said, I put it in the sky. I realized he was referring to the house fire that had prompted our family to move away from Miami in the early 80s. My mother sometimes made vague comments about my father having something to do with it, but now here he was, the man himself, talking about the house he'd torched. He also told me how much he loved my mother, still, but felt she'd turned my brother and sister and me against him. The fact that he carried a torch for my mother after all those years of life on the road in motels, hooker cribs, hideouts, and prison cells brought a surge of sadness I feared would spill right there in the car. I remember him driving away into the darkness. A few weeks after Newport's, I got a call informing me that Doc had been shot dead at his apartment in San Antonio. On December 4th, 1984, I was alone in the house, having just taken my 4-year-old son to his daycare. I needed to gather up some things before leaving for work in North Dallas. The phone rang. I picked up. "Hello, Jimmy?" said a man's voice. The caller introduced himself as Sam and said he was a friend of my dad's. He sounded friendly, like I knew him, but I didn't. Sam was calling me to tell me that Doc had been murdered at the door of his apartment that morning. Sam said there were no witnesses, but that word was Doc had been killed by two associates with whom he'd been robbing drug dealers at gunpoint. It seems these two had figured it would be easier to rob a 70-year-old man than it would be to rob young dealers. And Sam said Doc had about $50,000 in his apartment, but it was gone. He knew who the guys were, and he said he and his friends were going to get the mother effers. When he hung up, I rested my head on the kitchen table and cried like a lost child. The call kicked off what has become a 37-year search for truth and understanding. I wanted to know more about Doc's life, all the parts I'd never been shown or couldn't comprehend at the time. I wanted to understand this man, why he made the choices he had. And, of course, I wanted to know who'd killed him. About a week later, I got a call from Richard Urbanic, a San Antonio PD homicide detective, requesting that I come down to go through Doc's apartment with him. A faint metallic scent of blood mixed with the undertone of rot hit my nose as we entered Doc's efficiency pad. My father's blood, I thought. My blood. It struck me as more of a cell than a home. There was no art. A small table near a twin bed held a portable color TV. Against the wall, there was a wooden drying rack with T-shirts and underwear still hanging. Elsewhere, a stack of paperbacks, copies of The Ring magazine, an ashtray with a cigar stub. On his dresser sat a mix of matchbooks, paper scraps with nameless phone numbers, keys, eyeglasses. I was shocked to see syringes and ampules of scopolamine, a powerful hallucinogen sometimes used in kidnappings in Latin American countries. I spotted a small black-and-white photo with one corner missing. In the frame was a fat baby astride a pit bull terrier with a young, dark-haired woman holding him steady. The baby was me, the woman was my mother, and the dog may well have been Lady Girl, Doc's favorite dog. He had carried the photo with him for more than 30 years, through prisons, jails, motel rooms. A lump formed in my throat and wouldn't let go. "If you loved us so much, Doc, why did you leave?" When I was about 9, Lady Girl had a litter in our garage. Doc had taken an interest in dogfighting and had bred her with that in mind. But he said I could have one of the pups, a sturdy brindle male I called Billy. Billy grew to become a powerful animal. I recall taking Billy to Keist Park for training sessions that involved Billy harnessed to a rope that Doc held as he sat behind the wheel of our blue Ford coupe. Billy ran alongside the car, pulling us slowly, panting and foaming at the mouth with the effort. He never quit. At some point, Doc decided to take Billy on a car trip just to see how he'll do. He returned without Billy and told me the dog had gotten in a fight and was hurt so badly he had to be killed. In May 1985, a lawyer called to tell me probate was complete on Doc's estate, which amounted to a brown paper bag holding $45,000 in cash, a Seiko watch, a cheap ring, and some odds and ends. The lawyer asked if I had seen the San Antonio newspaper. "They did a big article on your dad's murder," he said. The front page of the Express News from May 1985 bore the headline, "Man slain in SA, tied to JFK assassination." Near the headline was a picture of Doc wearing tinted glasses. On the inner pages were photos of Carlos Marcello, Felix Aldericio, and Santo Traficante. Marcello and Traficante were thought by some in law enforcement to have ordered the hit on JFK. For the first time, I felt like I could see behind the curtain that my father used to hide his life. The Express News story connected Doc to Jack Ruby and tied him to a JFK conspiracy theory. The reporter, Bill Hendricks, wrote that Doc had done collections work for these top mafiosi. When he was killed, according to the newspaper article, Doc was a key witness in a probe of South Texas drug dealing and contract murder. The investigation was codenamed Operation Bushmaster, and just hours before he was killed, he'd negotiated through his attorneys for immunity from federal prosecution in exchange for his testimony before a grand jury. According to the story, 6 9-millimeter bullets pumped into Dolan late last year put the grand jury out of business. That jolted me. It seemed logical that his murder had been a hit. In fact, a detective was quoted in the story saying, "It doesn't appear to be the motive was burglary or robbery." I thought back to my conversation with a man calling himself Sam. Why did he tell me it was a robbery? Was Sam in on it? Had I actually spoken to the man who had murdered my father? Late in 2019, I finally received Doc's heavily redacted FBI file. It is 1,500 pages covering only the years 1971 through 1978, when he was on the lam after pulling a swindle in Memphis. I'd already been warned about some of what I'd find. Doug Swanson, a former Dallas Morning News reporter, said, and author of Blood Aces, a book about the famous hoodlum Benny Binion, had called me earlier, trying to verify information he had uncovered related to the 1972 Las Vegas car bombing death of attorney William Coulthard. Binion had wanted Coulthard taken out. The likely bomber? Doc Dolan. Working through Doc's FBI files, I eventually found something that stopped me cold. I came across a narrative of Doc attending a cockfight in the Trinity River Bottoms near Northwest Highway in 1973. An informant placed him there and implicated him in the murder of two men who were also there and had stolen a money-making dog from an associate of Doc's a week prior. Their bodies were found on New Year's Eve at a campground on the Elm Fork of the Trinity, with gunshot wounds to their heads and their hands bound behind them with neckties. Somehow the Coulthard bombing seemed abstract, while this cockfight scenario seemed too real to me and churned my stomach. Doc was a murderer. Earlier this year, I answered a call while driving. A woman with a deep country accent was on the other end. She reminded me that her daddy and Doc had once been the closest of friends. I remembered her daddy's name from childhood. She was drunk and rambling. She described herself and her family as mafia. I was wondering what the nature of the call was when she blurted out, "I think my daddy killed your daddy, because I think he was afraid with that big investigation that Doc would testify on what all we was up to." I assumed she was talking about Operation Bushmaster. One night after a few beers, Doc told me a story about a machine he once sold to suckers. This machine, with the turn of a crank, would print perfect $100 bills. Thing was, it didn't really print them. The machine spit out bills that had been loaded into it before the demonstration, just enough to convince the buyer. He told me the marks paid big bucks for a counterfeiting machine. Did the machine actually exist? I don't know, but his pantomime of how it worked was believable. And what's more, I wanted to believe it. In the same way I wanted to believe when I was a kid that Davy Crockett killed a bear with his bare hands. Telling the story, his eyes sparkled with mirth, while I filled with pride and laughed along with him. But beneath the laughter and the shame-shaded pride, I was sad. No, it was something else, pity. This brilliant, witty, handsome, charismatic man had accomplished nothing. He left his wife to raise his children on her own, while he roamed the country committing murders, arson, armed robbery, and who knows what else. I've wandered for years in the mirror palace of my father's life, always driven by the idea that I'd eventually arrive at the final truth. And here it was, sitting in plain sight. Everyone in his life was a mark, with something in his or her heart that made him or her vulnerable to his con. I might be the only buyer there ever was for the counterfeiting machine, its first and best customer. I openly admit I bought the con, and I knew it was the only way to be close to Doc. For all the trouble it has caused me, all the PTSD, the night terrors in childhood, the harassment by the FBI, all of it, I have no regrets, because I am still his mark. As I type these lines, I am still searching to understand him, and the search will go on. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in D magazine. We're on the Talking Points page. I think we've got time for a couple of articles. University of Austin. Game changer or stunt? The upcoming launch of the University of Austin could be the best news in academia in a long, long time, said Quinn Hillier in WashingtonExaminer.com. Former St. John's College president Pano Canellos announced last week his plans to create a fiercely independent new institution of higher learning. His co-founders, columnist Barry Weiss and Palantir co-founder Joe Lonsdale, among them, include conservatives and classical liberals who prize free speech. Their dream, a haven where scholars and students can engage in open, rigorous debate, what great colleges offered until they were hijacked by the illiberal left. Here's why I've joined them, said historian Niall Ferguson in Bloomberg.com. Recent surveys have found that 62% of college students said that their campus progressive orthodoxy made them fearful of expressing their opinions. Put simply, higher ed is broken. How seriously should we take this new unwoke university, asked Alex Shepard in NewRepublic.com. Not very. UATX doesn't have a campus, accreditation, or degree programs yet, just an offering cryptically called the Forbidden Courses. Rather than transcending identity politics issues, the university boasts a founding faculty that seems determined to relentlessly burrow into them. From one side, including such firebrands as British philosopher Kathleen Stock, who has been at war with transgender activist, and pundit Ayan Hirsi Ali, who has called Islam a nihilistic cult of death. Will the school offer a degree in owning the libs? Its website largely consists of a plea for money from any wealthy donors who might also like to stand athwart history yelling stop. Sounds like a largely half-baked hustle. Problems are already surfacing, said A.J. McDougall in thedailybeast.com. Two marquee named scholars, evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker and University of Chicago Chancellor Robert Zimmer, quit the advisory board this week, evidently uncomfortable with statements from some far-right founders made about UATX's mission. To succeed, said Daniel Dresner in the Washington Post, the university will need large-scale investments of hundreds of millions of dollars provided by plutocratic donors. But would the rich bet on the cantankerous crew behind this project, many of whom are not educators, rather than giving money to their prestigious alma maters? Maybe, just maybe, those potential donors are exercising their own kind of independent thinking. Woke, the meaning of a tarnished label. The word woke used to have a meaning, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, but it's become an empty all-purpose insult hurled by conservative propagandists, anti-vaccine fabulists, and reactionaries who deny the existence of racism and sexism. Originally, woke was popularized in the African-American community to describe waking up to the racism and bigotry that permeated this country's history and present. These days, I never hear people of color, LGBTQ Americans, or any other constituencies of the supposed woke mob use the word. Instead, you hear it from elites desperate to flout their populist credentials. Even NFL star Aaron Rodgers is now whining about the woke mob was persecuting him after he lied about receiving the COVID vaccine. Conservatives are master marketers, said Charles Blow in the New York Times, and they've made the woke brand toxic as a way of demeaning any assessment of history and society that makes them uncomfortable. Wokeness doesn't have a branding problem, said Noah Rothman in commentary.org. It is a defective product. Having grown far beyond an earnest attempt to confront racial injustices, wokeness now encompasses the belief that America is irredeemably racist. Men and women are not biologically distinct, even when it comes to the ability to give birth, and that the free expression of unfashionable opinions is an artifact of the white man's culture. Wokeness even extends to erasing words and replacing them with ludicrous new terms, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. If you use poor rather than oppressed, or Latino instead of Latinx, you are guilty of a microaggression and must be silenced and punished. This isn't silly, it's Orwellian. The solution to left-wing intolerance, however, isn't right-wing intolerance, said David French in barryweiss.substack.com. More than 20 states have introduced legislation that dictates what public schools can teach about America's racial history. A Texas state official is demanding that school libraries admit whether they have books on a list of 800 titles that might make students feel psychological distress because of their race or sex, including such respected works as The Confessions of Nat Turner. In my own Nashville suburb, parents sought to ban books about Martin Luther King Jr. and the civil rights hero Ruby Bridges. Silencing ideas is un-American, whether you call yourself woke or anti-woke. And here's a few of the shorter notes. A New Jersey man was sentenced to 41 months in prison for assaulting a police officer during the January 6th Capitol riot, the longest sentence yet resulting from the uprising. Scott Fairlamb, a former MMA fighter who was among the first to break into the Capitol, pleaded guilty to punching an officer in his face shield, an act caught on video. In the run-up to the 2020 election, at least 13 Trump administration officials violated the Hatch Act, which bars federal employees from using taxpayer resources for partisan political purposes, according to a watchdog report. The result was a taxpayer-funded campaign apparatus within the upper echelons of the executive branch, said the Office of Special Counsel. The tight labor market and concerns of COVID risk have created a shortage of Santas, leaving many organizations that run holiday events scrambling to find bearded men in red suits. Working Santas are raising their rates as high as $200 an hour, and they're so overbooked that some holiday events are being held early. On the poll watch, 27% of Americans say the Supreme Court should overturn Roe v. Wade, while 60% say it should be upheld. 75% of Americans say abortion access should be left to women and their doctors, while 20% say it should be regulated by law. And we'll finish with a quote from author Zadie Smith, quoted in The Guardian, who said, "Death is sort of an affront to American life. It is so anti-aspirational." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.